welcome back to this week's episode of Make Climate Cool Again. I'm your host, Sarah Miltenberger, and here we are for this week's episode talking about the benefits of electric vehicles and sort of what the future looks like. And you guys know I used to work for Tesla, and it was my favorite job experience ever. Even though it was the craziest, it was the best. And maybe that's how it all, the crazy decisions that we make in our lives sometimes end up being the most valuable ones. So I could talk about EVs all day, and Vartan Badalian from the Climate Group was just so interesting to talk to. He is like doing what I had always wanted to do growing up. So it was kind of really interesting to chat with him and hear his story about how he went and studied environmental law, and then he was working in-house, and now he's trying to transition the world into EVs, and just get to know his story, because that was something I always had wanted to do. So I was just living vicariously through him. And I know we don't always talk about we talk decently about policy on the podcast, and I mentioned it in the interview as well. I think it can be really hard to grasp policy because there's so many levels of it, right? But we don't even realize that policy controls our lives, right? We have local policy in terms of just general social unwritten policies that define our environments. We have policies that are jobs. We have policies in our towns. We have policies in our states. We have policies at the federal level, and they all kind of mix together to create the experience that we live every day. And we don't always get to make the biggest impact on federal policy, right? We don't get to make all those changes, but I think the beauty is that we can really make a difference in the local policy, in the experience that we regularly have every day. We can make a difference in that way. And a lot of people ask me about being a sustainability consultant, and I always say start changing the policy where you are, because that's what I do all day long. It's all about figuring out, how do we change policy in our businesses? How do we come up with an environmental program? How do we have a recycling policy? What's our e-waste policy? Blah, blah, blah. All these different things. And it's something that I've realized a lot of small businesses don't have. We just don't have them, because we're all operating the way we think we need to operate. Policies are for big companies, but it's also the thing that holds us back from certifications, and it holds us back from hiring sometimes, because we don't have clear-cut expectations of how we operate. So I think something that I'm going to be exploring with my team is, how do we create really interesting and easy to implement policies for small businesses that make sense? Because it's one of the hardest things to wrap your head around when you're a small business and you're doing 8 million other things, and sitting down and writing your purchasing policy in terms of how much do you purchase that's made from post-consumer recycled content? Do you actually prioritize paper that's FSC certified versus not? Like, these are all things that matter when it comes to a sustainability strategy in a company, and it's complicated. So anyway, I think that was interesting that we got into that conversation, because it's inspired a bigger train of thought for me in terms of how can we continue to make a difference in companies and make a difference in the planet and make positive climate change, which is what this podcast is all about. And I think that we're going to continue to see a trend here as we really start the Green Biz 30 Under 30 series. If you want to check out that list of some really amazing individuals that are taking action and making positive climate change in their communities and their companies, whether they've started a company or whether they work for a big company, they are doing the most. And not only are they just fascinating to talk to because they have accomplished so much Like, I am inspired by them. Like, I want to be them. So I thought that it would be great to bring some of them on and talk about their experiences. And Vartan is one of them. He's a Green Biz 30 Under 30 award winner. And he's just a great person to chat with. I was definitely living vicariously through him because he's doing really cool work. And you guys know how much I wish sometimes I worked in the EV space. But we are making a difference in each way that we can. No matter where we are, we have an opportunity every day to do something positive for the planet. And so that is my challenge for you this week. Find one thing to do this week that you are like, okay, I'm making positive climate change today. Because we all have the earth in common. So I'm excited to get into this interview. I hope you enjoy it. I'll see you guys on social and share the podcast, share the episode with someone who you've had a conversation about EVs with or wants to get an EV, because this is a good convo. And I hope you enjoy it. Stay golden. So I am sitting here in the virtual podcasting studio with Vartan Badalian, who is the EV100 program manager for the Climate Group. And he recently won the Green Biz 30 Under 30 recognition award. And I'm really excited to be chatting with him because, you know, you guys know how I feel about EVs, and I could just talk about EVs all day long. And this is just, it's going to be super fun. So thank you so much, Vartan, for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Sarah. And I just want to know, obviously you gave me my title perfectly, but I'm speaking here on behalf of my personal self. Obviously the views of the Climate Group are so similar to my own, but just wanted to plug that note in first, but thank you.
Awesome. Love it. I mean, I work for myself, but I feel like everyone who's been on here, I think I should remember to say that in the beginning of every podcast, because it's
important. Yes, my legal hat just came on, and I have to mention it. But yes.
Now, we were talking before we jumped on the recording, we were talking about our weekends and how it's so busy now that we're kind of moving into back to normal. We're kind of getting thrown into all the activities. And you mentioned that you were just at a Formula E race. Now, I had the pleasure of going to a race when I lived out in California, when I was living near Laguna Seca, but I've never been to like a Formula E specific race. So I'd love to know more about that. You're in New York City. So where is that even? Where can people like go? I'd love to hear more about it.
I'm just coming off of it fresh, so I'm happy to dive into that. I mean, it's actually extremely exciting. And it's one of the more exciting races, I think, at Formula E, because they do it all around the world. So I had the pleasure, and the privilege to go on behalf of the Climate Group, because we, as an organization, the Climate Group is a supporting partner, a supporting NGO of Formula E, because the mission of Formula E is so ingrained and obviously progressing the EV adoption around the world, because it's entirely electric based racing. So the race actually happens in Red Hook, Brooklyn, which is, if you know Brooklyn, I mean, a little bit more flat compared to Manhattan, so it's a little bit more possible. It's like right on like the edge of the water. And it's a pretty industrial circuit. I love it. I haven't been to any other race personally, Formula E around the world. So I only have Brooklyn race the perspective. But when I found out, I think 3 or 4 years ago, I've since been going, aside from this prior year because of COVID. I've since been going, and it's just an amazing time. You can just feel the energy. So it's so alive and electric. Yeah, if you ever have a chance or anyone has a chance, I think they should definitely check it out, because it's an amazing time for sure.
So actually, I am familiar with Red Hook, because when I was an environmental scientist years and years ago, that was actually where one of my last projects was before Red Hook was like all built up, and it's amazing. But wait, I have to know, is there an actual racetrack in Red Hook, or is it like street racing, like Need for Speed?
So it's like an industrial area. So they cut off a certain portion of the actual pedestrian streets, and then from there, it's all like you can't enter. And then they built a track with like fencing on the actual roads and like industrial parts of Red Hook. So it's very industrial, and I think it adds to the excitement of the race. I was speaking to some of the Formula E staff, and they have traveled all around the world, and they say New York City is unlike any other race, because just you have the New York City skyline right there, the Statue of Liberty on one side, and you have these performance electric vehicles just driving on what would have been streets and industrial parts of the Red Hook. And I think you just, the energy is so alive. And New York obviously provides that energy.
That's cool. I like grew up with playing like Need for Speed video games with my dad. And I feel like, you know, driving through the streets, like Fast and Furious, like that's the vibe I'm getting from this particular race. And, you know, one thing I learned when I was out in Laguna Seca watching this electric vehicle race was that I guess typically at raceways, you can only race during certain times of the day because there's like noise rights. And a lot, I guess EVs though can race at any time of day because they're silent. They don't make all the like sounds that race cars make, which I thought was just really interesting. How does that like play into the excitement of the race?
I mean, so it's not entirely soundless. There is still a noise that comes from these performance vehicles because they're obviously operating at such high speeds, but it's a very addicting sound. Like it's a sound, I think I read on Twitter, someone said like, if you're wondering what this like whistle sound is in Brooklyn, then there's a Formula E race happening today, on Saturday and Sunday, because there's like, it's like accelerating like spaceship sound that happens when the vehicles start accelerating, which you can find typically in many EVs. It's just way more intensified in these performance vehicles. But personally, if I had to choose between the traditional Formula One race vehicles, which have the intense engines, and the Formula E, I would pick Formula E because it's just the sound, obviously. It's just, it's an addicting sound to listen to, I think.
Okay, wow. I'm seeing it now. That's crazy. Yeah. I thought like, I'm thinking of the race I went to, it was like people had either were racing Tesla performance cars or they had built out their own electric vehicles in other shapes, like, or in like a Shelby body or a Porsche body, but they were all electric.
Yeah, this is very different. So this is true performance racing, just like Formula One is. Formula One and Formula E are, I think, are competitors to each other, but the same style racing. Actually, traditionally, aside from, I think, this shift because of COVID, they had limitations about what they could bring, but typically they have like those regular passenger cars as well. So they come, it's like a whole village you can hang out at and like see like the new EVs that are coming to market. I think one year Harley had their EV there. Harley had their motorcycle there. So it's just an experience for anyone who's enthusiastic about EVs.
I love it. That's so cool. Now let's kind of like get into your background a little bit, because I mean, we're going to talk a lot about EVs today, but you know, it's always interesting to know, like, how did you get into EVs? Like, obviously you, even though you manage the EV100 program, you have a law degree from Lewis and Clark University, which we've talked about. And, you know, I'd love to kind of hear about, okay, that obviously wasn't in electric vehicles. So how, like, what's your story? How did you kind of like find your way into EVs?
Sure. So I'm always been passionate about addressing climate. Actually, I was born on Earth Day. So this has kind of like been written in the stars for me in some way.
That's so cool.
At least I want to believe that, at least.
You're the second person on this podcast that was born on Earth Day.
I want to be the first.
Crazy. I'm sorry you couldn't be the first, but like that is wild to me.
Yeah. Well, after this, we should definitely, I'm curious to see who that person is. I would love to meet him or her. Because it's not often I meet someone like that who's also interested in climate. But obviously that's been a guiding force for me. So I attended actually SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry for my undergraduate, which is a small SUNY school in Syracuse, New York, which is where I was raised. And that kind of like was the first moment of my like education where I was fully entrenched in environmental sciences. And I was actually focused on sustainable energy management, which at the time when I was doing that in 2013, 2014, was when the renewable energy industry was just picking up and becoming big. So I noticed and I knew that like I needed to get more education. I needed to go into graduate school, but what that would look like was still uncertain. But I knew I wanted to still stay in climate and addressing climate change. So I sought out, obviously, to go to either the number one or whatever law school that was focused on environmental law. And that happened to be Lewis and Clark, which is, if you know, in Portland, Oregon, and is world renowned for their environmental law program. But yet I did not know exactly what I wanted to focus on. And I thought energy law was going to be that path for me because I was continuing on the energy path. And it was during law school that Tesla started kind of becoming more popular. So around 2015, you saw the first Model S kind of come out on the road and people were driving it, and it was still an early adopter thing. And I knew, like, this is it. Like, electric vehicles are going to be the next, like, wave where renewable energy was when I was still an undergraduate. And at that moment, I decided that I'm going to invest my entire self in transportation. And I started having various clerkships. If you're familiar with the law school model, you do kind of clerkships throughout your summers. I was focused on that for the summers during law school, and then at various organizations. And then from there, postgraduate school, I took the bar. I finished that, put that aside. And I've since then been working in the EV space because, as I luckily predicted correctly, it is booming, and rightly so, because transportation is the leading source of emissions here in the United States. So it makes sense to start targeting that aggressively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the trajectory of renewable energy and the sort of the requirement for more renewables in partnership with the demand for EVs is going to be very interesting to watch over the next few years. And we're going to get into that energy situation a little bit later on. But I wanted to, you know, ask you specifically about environmental law for two reasons. One is, I remember I had, I mean, I might still have it, but I like had a Lewis and Clark, like one of those big, thick admissions books, because I was really interested in it when I was in college, because I thought like that's what I was going to do. I went into school studying political science and I wanted to be a judge, and I thought like that was going to be my future. And then I decided maybe law wasn't for me because I don't love following rules. I like creative. Then again, I guess being a lawyer, you are quite creative and like finding solutions, right? You're like finding ways to like address the law and like the problems about the law. Anyway, but I do feel like, you know, I run a clubhouse every single week about environmental consulting, sustainability consulting. And we get a lot of people that are actually either environmental lawyers or they want to be environmental lawyers. And I'd love to know from your perspective, there are a lot of people trying to break into this space, or they're like lawyers and they want to move into environmental law. What advice would you give for anyone who's thinking about that? Or maybe they're in college now and they're thinking about law school. What advice would you give?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. Because I think a lot of people have interest in going to law school, and then in law school, they figure out that maybe it's not their interest to be a lawyer. I still am on the side of the bandwagon that I think even if you decide law school isn't right for you during law school, you should finish, because the degree is so useful no matter what you do in life. So that kind of feeds into the answer, which is, I think environmental law, as I come to know it and learned about it in Lewis and Clark, breaks down into two different buckets. One is like the group who's extremely passionate about litigating and being a traditional lawyer and going after polluters or big companies that are breaking the law when it comes to the environment. I think those people are like one category that if you're interested about actually being a traditional lawyer, that would be the route that you would go down, and you would be dealing with working at a top name law firm around the world or in the United States and focused on really addressing what is a major issue, which is pollution, and just bringing justice for the environment. The other bucket or bandwagon of people I think fits into where I am personally, and where a lot of people also do end up eventually going to after they litigate, which is working on policy, working in this area, like working for an NGO or working for a company and their policy or legal team, but not focused traditionally on environmental law. So for my personal example, I did actually go down the traditional route and became general counsel for in-house counsel, not general counsel, big distinction. In-house counsel for a small startup EV charging company. And then from there, I've pivoted to now being in the policy space. So I think the recommendation is you have to really figure out, are you truly interested about law and regulations, and really that's what interests you? And you can figure that out before you go to law school by working as an intern for a law firm. If the law aspect of environmental law interests you, then environmental law will be something that you're good at and you want to be in, because no matter, you can't detach the law from environmental law. So you have to be interested in law and regulations and working on that to be good at environmental law. But the law degree has served me wonders, even if not practicing traditional law, because I think if you're interested about being a really good writer, being able to distill information correctly for the general public to understand, I think these are all skills that anyone should have. And I think it can benefit anyone if they truly want to endure the 3 years education. And then if they want to even pass the bar, I think it all helps anyone in their professional career.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's interesting you said that, because it's very hard to talk about policy sometimes on a podcast focused towards like consumers and regular people, mm-hmm. but also policy determines how we interact and how we buy things and how we make decisions because of the cost effectiveness of it. And it also drives change. And it's just an interesting sector, but there's a lot, it's very complicated as well. So I think it's good to have you on to kind of talk more about why the climate group and the policy and the EV policy that you're working on is so important.
I mean, I fully agree. I think it's complex for people to get involved on policy, but there's opportunity all around you. And like you said, engaging on local policy is a place where you can really have an impact. I know when I was working at GreenSpot, we focused on deploying charging in the public right of way. And then we focused on coupling that with like car sharing programs, EV car sharing programs. And we often had to go to a local public hearing or public comment opportunity to really make our case for why we wanted this specific easement in place, for why we want this specific program to launch. And then the local government had to obviously vote on it in a public hearing, and then it would get approved or disapproved. So there were a number of things you can bring, not just EV related, you can bring anything to your local government to petition to have it implemented. I think these are the moments when opportunities where if someone really wants to get engaged, they can obviously get engaged on a local level. And then even on the federal level, you can still get engaged. You can attend public hearings for what any agency is doing, DOT, EPA, and really advocate for what you want to happen, which is right now very timely and what's happening in the US.
Right, and yeah, I think policy is complicated as you scale up from local government to state to federal.
Yep.
But also, we tend to forget about the policies that are around us in our jobs, right? Like I always encourage people when they say like, I don't really know where to get started in sustainability, if like that's something they want to work in or they want to do something at their company. It's like, review your company's policies. Start a sustainability program, create recycling policies at your work. Like there's so many areas where policies are all around us. And I think that there's something to be said about like starting small and starting where you are and then kind of like working your way up as you understand more about what you're trying to change and how you want to scale that change. So let's talk more about the climate group. What is the climate group? Just give us a brief overview.
Absolutely. So the climate group actually is an international NGO. We are headquartered in the UK, and we have offices all around the world. So I'm based in New York. You can't tell from my, if you can on a video, you can tell from my brick wall right behind me, very cliche New York. And then we have offices in India. We have offices in Asia and operations all around the world, because we are targeting major emitting regions from around the world. And the work that we do as an NGO is unique because it breaks down into kind of what I like to look at as two different buckets. One is we work with major corporates and companies, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, right now. In which case we have like business action programs and campaigns where companies can sign on to commit to either going 100% renewable, improving the energy productivity, or sourcing 100% electric vehicles as we define it for their fleet and more programs like that. And then we have government work, which we're working with like through our Under 2 Coalition, which is a group of like 200 plus governments from around the world that have committed to the Paris Climate Agreement. So we work with them to move policy and knowledge sharing around the world. And then I guess now we have a third bucket, but like we kind of bring it all together at what we uniquely host and own, which is a Climate Week in New York City. And it happens each year in September alongside the United Nations Summit in New York. And it's really a moment where we bring all our community together because we are a convener from that respect, bring everyone together to talk about what they've done on climate and what they're going to be doing on climate. And our companies that are part of our campaigns love to get involved to share what they're doing. They make major announcements during Climate Week. And it's really a moment where we benchmark what's happened in a year. Beyond that, not just what we control, which is what we call the hub, which is 3 days of the beginning of the week. Anyone has an opportunity, large or small, big company or individual, to host a Climate Week event. They can list it on our website, the Climate Week website, and they can really get involved actually by having their own climate event on any topic they want, environmental justice, electric vehicles, energy, and they get the branding of Climate Week and they get our support on social media and communications. And really this is how we're trying to bring everyone together each year. So that's at a high level how the Climate Group kind of breaks down to the unique NGO space that's very much cluttered right now on climate.
Wow, everyone listening, get ready. Yes. When is Climate Week so people can start preparing for their events and their talks and all the things?
It's in the end of September and my team's going to kill me on the exact date. I think it's September 21st or 26th, but that week, the end of September, 21st or 22nd, I can't forget the exact first day, but it's on our website, theclimategroup.org. And you can check it out. And anyone who's interested can host an event and be a part of Climate Week.
Wow. Everyone, create events, educate people. I'm going to have an event. I'm going to have my team brainstorm. I love that. So 102 companies have signed on to transition their fleet to EVs by 2030, which is awesome. I think IKEA was one. What are some other big names that have signed on?
Genentech, Lyft, Siemens, AVB, the list goes on.
Oh, that's awesome. But I think I'm curious as to what's stopping more companies from signing up? Like, what is needed? Is there laws needed? Is there technology needed? How can we get this number to like 500? Is that just manpower or is that like, is there something stopping companies?
You're putting me on the wire because it's partially my job and the job of everyone else working at EV100. Why isn't it growing faster? Actually, some of that growth, since we last spoke, now we have 111 companies part of EV100. So we gained a few more. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And I can tell you, getting the first 100, while I wasn't a part of the full getting to 100, I was part of the end part of it. I joined the Climate Group. I think getting the first 100 was far more difficult than what's going to be getting the next 100 from 100 to 200 and so on, because the momentum is building. In conversations that you have with any company, even 3 of 100 in general, companies are a little bit slow moving. You obviously have the big ones that like the outliers that want to move quick, and they do move quick, but typically a company will move small. I'm sure you have also experienced that through your work, because they need to go through layers of staff to figure out what's right. I think what's stopping some companies from figuring out they can commit to EV100, because the process usually takes around 6 months to a year for any company from get-go, beginning to the end to join, is on really realizing the market and what's going to happen by 2030. I think the uncertainty about will EVs, as we are trying to work towards, be the new normal by 2030, will that actually happen? And I think that's then where the next room of work that we do, policy, fits in. Because policy and government intervention can really provide certainty for a market from the OEM perspective, the automotive manufacturers, and they can provide certainty for companies and individuals to understand that the market's moving in one direction, so we can actually start working towards it. On top of government intervention and policy, which can help a company kind of feel more confident, EV100 is also that. Like EV100 is a demand signal. And as it grows, it proves for other companies that, hey, I have 111 of the world's biggest companies have committed to go electric for their fleet and deploy charging. Why can't I do it? So that's kind of the idea about how we anticipate we'll be growing faster and faster, because we target the industry leaders. When Lyft joined EV100 last summer, like it was a true leadership moment for the ride sharing industry. So Lyft came out as this huge company to commit to going 100% electric on their platform by 2030. That then later, a month later, we saw Uber make an announcement similar to that. So like that's the kind of change we want to see. Uber hasn't joined EV100 yet, but that's the change we want to see. If they're joining EV100 or not, we want to see the market moving forward. And I think the growth of EV100 is stimulating that for sure.
That's so cool. And I think, I mean, it makes sense that you can build traction by leaning on who's already signed up. But I mean, just saying like, oh, IKEA has signed up with us and Lyft and all these other companies that have a huge footprint and have a, also have a huge sort of consumer awareness to them. That's only going to help propel the movement a little bit forward, utilizing those industry competitors. And I think what, you know, and sort of to tie that back into energy policy and energy crisis that actually we talked about on the last episode of the podcast. So you guys should go check it out. If you haven't listened to it, go back, just pause, go back. You know, the transition to electric vehicles will continue to put pressure on the energy grid. And we are going to need to ramp up renewables to make sure we can ease into that transition seamlessly. And it's going to be really interesting how this all plays out, because I know that like everywhere right now is experiencing heat waves. We're experiencing extreme weather. There's more hurricanes. I'm having like internet outages on a Friday, which, you know, is not the worst thing in the world. But I know in New York, I actually just found this out today that you guys were texted, I think it was by the state government or the city government, to kind of say, hey, stop running your AC to save energy. But it's also, it's 100 degrees in New York City. So like, you know, how do like EVs play into this sort of chaos of the energy system here?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up New York. I also got that message. But I was also last weekend, or the prior weekend, I was in Phoenix, which has an immense EV adoption. I saw like on the road, there was like 1 in 10th or 1 in 12th car was a Tesla. So like, and in Phoenix, it's like 110 degrees every single day right now. There's no question what you're saying is very real. The grid wasn't built with the idea that we would have so much demand coming onto it. Even if you remove EVs from the picture, just we're growing as a population, we need more energy. So now you factor in EVs, it's a whole different game. But I think we're in a unique position now, which we're always starting to think about. There's unique applications of EVs that you can implement to really stabilize a grid, to really make it so that the grid isn't as impacted as it could be. I mean, what comes to mind is been thrown around every single day if you read about EVs, which is VGI, vehicle grid integration, because ultimately, if you have this giant moving battery, which typically is 100 kilowatts or 80 kilowatts of power, it's just stored very efficiently, and a vehicle typically doesn't move. The typical use of a vehicle in it every single day isn't because it's moving, it's probably permanently parked at a garage or on a driveway. So if you have vehicle to grid integration technology and programs built out with utilities and these automotive companies, you can really work around the grid limitations by having vehicles operate as backup power. When the grid is in need of energy, you can enter into a program with your utility and automotive company to really supply power from your stored battery in your vehicle to the grid. And then when the grid is no longer needing the energy, you can charge your vehicle back up. And these are all programs that are, I think, already being tested on pilot stages around the United States, around the world. And the application of that will only grow as more EVs come online, to a point where in 2030, 2035, we have millions and millions of EVs in the United States and around the world. So I think that's just one aspect right there. But I mean, yeah, the grid is becoming more disrupted. Heat waves and climate is going to have greater impact, but that shouldn't deter us from going to an all-electric future, because we can do it right now. And we're proving that right now. You just need smart policies in place and critical thinking to understand how does this new technology work? And we just need to have that conversation, and not just ignore it, because it's a conversation worth having, and it can really benefit us if we do implement it correctly.
Wow. I know that Tesla sells batteries for the home. My parents have Tesla solar. They have a Tesla. All they're missing is the battery at this point. But if they could utilize the battery of their vehicle when, and they actually, they bought a generator recently because, and I was so disappointed. I was like, you did all these other things.
Yeah.
And just whatever. But where they live deep in the woods of Connecticut. I remember last summer we lost power at least once a week. Like it was for, and not even just for like an hour, like 2 hours, 5 hours.
Wow.
Just from trees coming down from summer storms or someone being an idiot and driving to a pole, whatever. Or even just slight changes sometimes can cause just outages. And I think what happens though is right as we experience more extreme heat and we experience more extreme weather, we are going to be in situations where we don't have power and we're going to be extremely uncomfortable because everything we do is like, we're talking on a computer right now, powered by electricity with internet and all these other things, our microphones, all this stuff, all of our smart homes and technologies are all connecting to our internet and our, which is connected to the grid. And we're putting so much pressure and we're not necessarily as consumers thinking a lot about our usage other than how much we're paying. Like we're not necessarily understanding how that plays into like a bigger system. And I'm curious, you know, I didn't ask this in your agenda, but just to kind of put you on the spot, what do you think would be one of the best ways for people to kind of have a greater understanding of their electricity usage and how they can do a little bit better, how like EVs would help also solve a problem in the future for them? That was a bad question.
No, it tees up very nicely. To be honest, it's kind of a two-part answer, if you don't mind.
Let's do it.
I think the one aspect is how does a person understand more about their energy usage and how they're consuming energy? The other part is if they're fortunate enough to afford a vehicle and are thinking about EVs, how can an EV help them if they own a home, impact that usage? So I think for anyone who's living in an apartment or anywhere consuming energy, I think it's worthwhile to look at your bill if you're interested to see how much are you actually consuming. I know like Con Edison right now provides me like a real-time usage of like my actual energy. That's like clearly showcasing when I wake up, energy goes up. And then so far I've turned AC, it goes up even more. And then when I'm sleeping, it goes down. So understanding how you're consuming energy can really impact what decisions you make. Obviously, it's smart to unplug certain devices you're not using, buy LED bulbs that are really efficient and don't consume a lot of energy. These are basic things you can do, but like understanding how you consume energy, your patterns, and then being like, I think this is just my mantra is always being cognizant and conscious of what you're doing, no matter what it is in life, I think is the real way to live. Because if you're conscious about what you're doing, and what you're consuming, then you can really make adjustments in what you're doing to really benefit the planet, benefit yourself, benefit your wallet. That's one example, just understand how you're consuming. And then if you're buying an EV, you can potentially start looking into VGI if it's available in your utility district, if your vehicle that you've purchased has VGI capabilities. I know the Ford F-150, for example, that's going to be released next year, that everyone's talking about, the electric F-150. That is like the big deal in the EV industry, because the F-150 is the best-selling vehicle in the United States. That will have VGI in it. So we will be able to be a generator for your home when there's a power outage. So your parents, if they want an F-150, they can have that, and they can have a generator for their home in the case the power goes out. That obviously there has to be utility programs in place to allow that for your battery from your vehicle to go back into the grid and then to supply your home with energy and so forth. But this is the kind of thinking that you should be doing to understand how can my vehicle potentially be a benefit beyond just moving me from point A to point B. And it's complex. It's not easy. Typically, we've only had to think about filling up gas and driving from point A to point B. But I think when you're thinking about new tech, I mean, it has always a slow adoption rate until you start getting enough people on it, and then it becomes a normal, like the smartphone.
I love that too, because I mean, yeah, the F-150 is, it's, I read a statistic a couple of years ago about how the F-150 and all of its sort of services around it, that includes like repairs and everything, like makes more money than Facebook does per year. Yeah. And that's insane. And people don't understand, like, cars have very small margins, and where most of these companies make money is on their repairs. And so there are, I'll give you an example. My family, my grandparents owned this van that we now have in our family, because, you know, sometimes vans are useful for moving, et cetera. And it has this like one light bulb that needs to be replaced in the front. But the way they designed this car was, you cannot just pop up the front. You can't just replace it yourself. It's like, you got to take the whole front end off, and you got to get a special bulb and this and that, and you got to pay someone to do it. And that is very intentionally designed by Chrysler, so that they are supporting the dealerships and the repair guys that kind of work with them to be able to make that sort of update in your car as needed. And so that kind of leads into my next interesting question that was not on the agenda, is how there is a really crazy shortage of cars right now. I mean, especially in SUVs and trucks, that chip that's in a lot of SUVs and trucks is not available. The car market is experiencing demand like they've never seen. People's cars are, it's kind of like their house. It's worth way more than it actually is. And so there's all this sort of excitement. I think a lot of people that I've talked to, they're getting these calls from their dealers saying, hey, we'll buy your car for like more than it's worth. And they're like, maybe I'll get an electric car. Maybe I'll transition sooner. Of course, if someone is buying your car, it's paying off your loan, and you don't have collateral necessarily to buy a new car. Just everyone should be aware. It's not like amazing deal, but it's something that some people are considering right now. And how has sort of the EV world been affected by the shortage? Do you know? Do you have any ideas or thoughts?
Yeah, that wasn't fully my remit to focus, but obviously just reading about the impact on the automotive market, you can tell. I know, like, even Tesla has been impacted by it. I think every OEM has been impacted by it. Obviously, it's raising prices on cars, as you mentioned. But I think it's a momentary glitch in the automotive market, but it's an example of what can come in the future as well. When you look at this specific situation, you can really apply it to in the future. If we don't correctly think about where the minerals in these batteries come from, for example, are they sustainably sourced, or where is the manufacturing of batteries happening, then that can potentially create future issues that we should be able to expect now that can have an impact on vehicle production and vehicle sales, and obviously has domestic and international policy implications. If you're relying on, for example, all of Asia for specific battery manufacturing that goes into vehicles in the United States, that's not really domestically sound to operate, which is why we are now looking at policies in the United States to really incentivize manufacturing in the United States, so we don't have glitches like this in the system where we have a shortage in vehicles now for semiconductors. In the future, it could be for batteries in general, or some other product or part of the vehicle. So I think it's a crystal ball of what can come in the future if we don't plan correctly. And I personally don't agree with some critics' idea that we shouldn't be moving toward 100% electric because we're relying currently on China for our battery manufacturing, because that'll just perpetuate the problem you're already in right now. We should be focusing on addressing the problem instead of letting it build more to a point where then we are only dependent on one region of the world for all of the parts that we need for an EV, or the major parts for an EV.
I completely agree. And actually, I remember speaking to someone, I don't know if it was the EV Coalition, Renewable Energy Vehicle Coalition, something along those lines, but they were like pushing for EV policy because, or at least in renewable energy, because, you know, we get all of our oil and gas from mostly other countries, which becomes a national security problem. And if we generate more renewable energy ourselves, then when we're charging our cars, we're keeping everything sort of in-house, so to speak. And we're not necessarily dealing with, you know, price wars with like Saudi
OPEC and
other areas.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, the perfect picture is 100% renewable grid combined with all EV. You are living the dream. And then you couple it with some nice battery recycling so that you can have, or in secondary and third useful life of these batteries, you are living an ideal dream for the transportation industry.
So let's talk more about consumers really quick, because for you and I, you know, there are a lot of really interesting incentives happening right now that are being discussed to make buying electric cars a little bit easier for regular people, more affordable. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what those are? Just to kind of get people excited about what's coming down the pipeline, because there's some pretty big things that they're going to be voting on in September.
Yeah, potentially some really big things. So, I mean, currently right now, there is still, I mean, so when you think about incentives and buying an EV, you can think about it along the layers of government. So there's a federal incentive in place, then there's state incentives in place. And typically it's smaller, much smaller, but there's city incentives in place, city and town incentives to procure an EV. You have to obviously do your research. Typically in an EV charging company, and if you're, their website has all this information, or like your local utilities has information to provide to you. But right now, the federally, there is a $7,500 tax credit for purchasing an EV, and you can still go ahead and utilize that, and it scales down depending on what vehicle you're trying to purchase. So like Tesla and GM vehicles don't qualify anymore because there's a cap of 200,000 vehicles sold, then they don't qualify for the full $7,500 tax credit. But like you just mentioned, right now, Congress is, there's various bills on the floor that are being moved through, in which case that'll raise, or first bring back the tax credit for all vehicles. So Tesla and GM will be eligible for it. So it'll raise that up and make that $7,500 again. And then for, I think the actual language is just one more of the prominent bills being moved forward. It adds an additional $2,500 for any vehicle that's domestically manufactured in the United States. They'll get an additional $2,500. And then on top of that, any vehicle that is made by workers that are a part of a union will get an additional $2,500. So really incentivizing U.S. manufacturing of vehicles, you could potentially get $12,500 for a new EV. Then you take that money, you can combine it with a state incentive program as well. So I read about yesterday, 2 days ago, New Jersey is doing something amazing. So they recently announced that you can get up to $5,000 off an EV as well, purchased in New Jersey. So you can combine that with a federal one. I don't know if you have to read obviously the terms and conditions and if you apply to be eligible, but they usually are work in conjunction with the federal programs. I mean, every state has some kind of program. So you can get potentially up to $20,000 off of an EV, which already EVs are becoming so price competitive at the point of purchase. And then when you add the useful life, like the entire period of owning a vehicle, that EV is far more smart of an investment because you don't want to pay for gasoline. There's very little maintenance. Electricity is very cheap. So then on top of that, you add this huge incentive because you're being given money to purchase an EV. It makes all the sense, I think, now, obviously in a year or 2 years ahead, to really purchase an EV. I think now we're going to see a massive adoption of EVs because of these smart policies that are going to be put forward and implemented. And not just New Jersey. New York has a program. I think you get $500 in New York if you purchase an EV that's above, I think, 60 grand. And then below 60 grand, you get up to 2,000. So it's incentivizing non-luxury vehicle, incentivizing everyday consumer vehicles, you can get the most credit for it. And these are programs that are all across the United States on various states and cities. So it's worth checking out your local utility and just Google searching simply what's available.
Yeah, I know Connecticut has, it's either $2,000 or $2,500, but it only is certain cars. It's only for like basically non-luxury, like not Model S or Model X, but Model 3. There's only certain Model 3s because, again, it's all like pricing. They're trying to take into account that they're trying to meet people where they are, not necessarily just like giving credits to like rich people that they can afford it anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think that's, it's really awesome that it's getting more affordable. And I think it's funny how those two particular stipulations about the 2500 being made in the US and not, and unionized workers, they kind of like clash for Tesla, because Tesla is domesticated, but they really do not want unions. At least when I was there, they didn't, because they are, it's very complicated. So I wonder how that's all going to go down, because most car companies are not producing 100 or making 100% of their car in the US. So at least Tesla gets that benefit. Maybe that's why it was designed that way. So very interesting and very exciting, because that is literally a game changer when it comes to making a purchase, because that is not, that's not for any other car, only EVs, which is very cool. It's like a discount, but better. So I'm curious, because I'm assuming you don't have a car because you're in New York City. So I have a two-part question. One is, what's your dream electric car that's like real, that already exists or is about to come out? And then what's your dream car that should be made electric?
Oh, okay. So I'm going to be very NGO-like and not pick a specific winner and loser, because I don't believe, the way I think about EVs and what EV I would want to buy, because I don't have a car, I live in New York City, is I'm looking for specific things that are being checked off, which I didn't think about when I would, if I would purchase a gasoline car. So if there's any EV, I mean, there are a lot now coming out that meet the desired range that is appropriate for an EV, which is typically around 280 to 300 plus miles. If it has that, and it has a reliable charging network or opportunity to charge reliably, and I know that for sure, these are the two things I'm looking for, because everything else is going to be there. The design is all futuristic now for these EVs. You look at the Audi e-tron, you look at the vehicles coming out from GM, look at the Ford F-150, Tesla, they're all futuristic. So these are there. So I'm really, to be fully frank with you, looking for vehicles that have the right range, which is 300 plus miles, and then an easy, reliable charging, because I'm going to be, you need to charge. So if charging is not reliable, I really do not care, to be honest, if the vehicle is great, because if the charging experience is not good, then it's going to deter and inhibit my enjoyment of the vehicle. And you don't want that. Even I, who am so enthusiastic about EVs, will not want to drive an EV if I cannot reliably charge it. And then, I mean, looking ahead, I'm extremely excited for every EV that I've seen be announced between now and 2022, 23. So looking at the Rivian's trucks, which are coming out this summer, look really exciting. I know Cadillac is coming out with a really nice designed EV. I can't pronounce it for the life of me, but the really cool SUV. These all have the right range. I know Rivian announced they're building out their own EV charging network, and they obviously have rely on the public network, which is great. So I think now we're at a time where it's not going to be so heavily dominated by Tesla, which isn't a bad thing. They did a great job moving the market, and I commend them. And I think everyone commends them for what they've done, which has changed the automotive market. But I think now we're going to see some more competition come in. And like, obviously, Tesla will have its own market share and market chunk of the world, because they're Tesla, and Tesla is a brand that they've developed very well. But we have some cool cars coming out, I think. And as the EV charging network becomes more reliable and builds out, I think we're going to see a really strong adoption of EVs as these OEMs make good on their promises.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really cool what they do, especially if they're going to create that charging network. Because you're right, like, that's so huge. That's the main reason why it's easier to get a Tesla for a lot of people, because it's totally built into their whole system. They they understand that you have to make it really easy for people to get from point A to point B, quite literally, and charge in between. And it'll be really also interesting to see how they capitalize on their presence in the charging world to kind of partner up with other companies that require that, you know, access. Because, you know, do they keep it and hold it tight to their chest and say, well, only Teslas get supercharger and all that stuff as their value add? Or do they kind of say, all right, like, we'll share with VW, we'll share with Ford, but you have to pay maybe a little bit more, or you have to, maybe there's going to be some kind of stipulation. I'm so curious as to how they're going to play that card, because it's probably one of their biggest values in terms of just their whole, they've built the entire system for you to live your most like sustainable life when it comes to energy, and how that is like even going to grow. But that was a good answer. And I think more companies are going to be pushing that boundary or reducing the boundary in terms of how far you can go. I know even my parents, they're like holding on to one of their vehicles because they're waiting for the new battery to come out from Tesla that they're going to be featuring. So then they'll be fully electric family, which would be very cool. But it's also all very expensive. But hopefully with those federal tax credits, it will all make a difference. And the last question I always like to ask as we kind of round out the episode here is, obviously you have been entrenched in the sustainability world for a long time. You studied it in undergrad too. I'm assuming you live a relatively eco-friendly life, but we are all imperfect. We cannot do things in the most sustainable way all the time. So I kind of always ask, you know, what makes you feel like a sustainability hypocrite? Because it's just important to show that we are imperfect and it's okay and we're doing our best.
This is something I personally, it's a great question. Yeah, because no one's perfect. And this is something I personally talk about with my friends, my family often, which is around plastic consumption and plastic use, especially single-use plastic. Obviously, I'm on the side that we should reduce and eliminate single-use plastic as much as possible in our daily usage. So I've been always the first to advocate for, don't get a shopping bag at the store. If you're carrying it, why do you need a plastic bag? So the same thing about using a plastic water bottle. I have the canteen, but obviously I'm imperfect. So I really feel guilty when it's a little bit more convenient for me to go ahead and grab that single-use plastic in a situation where I need it or I want it and it's convenient. After I do consume it, and I feel this guilt. So I always try to like leverage that guilt and really be cognizant, as going back to the beginning, where I said being conscious about whatever we're doing. I try to really remember that guilt and that feeling to really maybe think proactively about how can I eliminate that usage that I just sought out right now in the future. But yeah, no one's perfect. It's very hard to think about everything. But I think if you start being conscious, you can really make a difference slowly but surely. And I'm doing that proactively on plastic usage. Someone else might be doing it on composting and garbage. Someone might be doing it on their electricity usage. I think it's dependent on what's unique to you. But I think we all can have an impact for sure. And little by little, we can go.
Yeah, no, I feel that one. I feel that one in my soul. Because it is, I mean, especially, I think it's going to get a little bit easier now that we are kind of starting to step out of the COVID single-use bubble that we've been in terms of, God, we can't touch things. I mean, I think that people are also just more aware of germs a little bit more and are sensitive to that. But being able to bring in a reusable cup, I mean, it's just like a game changer. I feel better about buying coffee. But sometimes we don't always remember our reusable cup. And even for us, when we order takeout, we always say, like, don't bring utensils, whatever. But sometimes we get them and we actually keep them. I use them like to feed our cats and then we rewash them. Like that's how we, so we are like using them and putting them to a purpose. Or even if I have a coffee cup, I'll kind of use it a couple times and then recycle it. So it's just, it makes me feel a little bit better about it, but I know what you're saying. And, but it also sometimes is very hard to avoid. So that was a really good, that was a good answer. So thank you for sharing that with us. And I'm very just appreciative of you giving your time to the podcast today. I know you're very busy and you have a lot on your plate with the Climate Week coming up. Everyone should go check that out. And if anyone wants to reach out to you, connect, is that something that you're open to? Would you be able to kind of connect via LinkedIn? How can people get in touch?
Yeah, of course. I'm most available on LinkedIn. I have a Twitter as well, but LinkedIn is the primary where you can find me. And if you can just search me, my name, I should come up. Do reach out.
Great. And then for those small business owners that listen or other podcast guests that listen to the podcast, you should definitely check out the work that the Climate Group is doing and EV100. And maybe if you have a fleet, you guys could work together and
there we go.
Make that transition. So I don't have a promo code, but but it's something that that is definitely possible. So thanks for outlining that for everyone today. And yeah, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. I can talk about EVs for literally ever. I do wish sometimes I worked more in that space, maybe someday, but it was good to live vicariously through you.
Well, thank you for having me. And I'm sure if you want it, it'll happen, because I think if you sound very passionate, and I appreciate coming on and talking with you right now. Thank you.
Thank you so much.